Welcome to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. In recent weeks, this program has dedicated hours to providing you with a chance to speak directly with candidates in two important races, the 13th Congressional District race and the 52nd State Senate race. Today's guest is the Democrat running for Congress in Illinois' 13th District. David Gill is a Chicago native. He received his undergraduate and medical degrees here at the University of Illinois. He's worked as a family practice physician and an emergency room doctor in a number of central Illinois communities. This is Dr. Gill's fourth campaign for Congress. He lost to incumbent Congressman Tim Johnson in 2004, 2006, and 2010. This year, Congressman Johnson is retiring, and Dr. Gill faces two other candidates to represent the newly drawn 13th District, Republican Rodney Davis, who will appear on this program next week, and Independent John Hartman, who was on this show last month. The three men are seeking to represent a district that covers a lot of territory and winds its way through east central Illinois, westward all the way to areas in the metro east of St. Louis. Among the cities included in the 13th District are Champaign-Urbana, Bloomington-Normal, Decatur, Springfield, and the metro east communities of Collinsville and Edwardsville. Dr. David Gill, welcome to Focus.
Thank you, Craig. It's a pleasure to be here.
While I have much that I can ask you, ultimately, the purpose of this hour is to give listeners a chance to question you directly. And I do hope that you will do so by joining us by phone at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Again, to provide your questions to Dr. Gill by phone, you can call 333-WILL, 800-222-9455. WILL. We also welcome questions on WILL's Facebook page. You can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is Will Public Media. And as we are awaiting primarily phone calls and emails, I think it's instructive, Dr. Gill, for voters to learn a little bit about every candidate's life outside of the political arena, just to get a sense of who you are and where you come from. The first non-political, non-professional thing that leaped out to me about you is that you were born on Christmas.
Yes, I'm a Christmas baby.
I have a brother who was born on Valentine's Day. My birthday is usually pretty close to Thanksgiving. How did being born on Christmas affect your birthday celebrations as a kid?
You know, my parents took great pains to make sure that we still made a fuss over my birthday. So Christmas was Christmas in the morning, and then in the evening, after all the hubbub had settled down, then there would be a cake and a couple more presents. And so people have said to me, didn't you feel ripped off through the years? And I never did. And in fact, there's something very special about having the whole world, you know, celebrating and joyous on one's birthday. And I always appreciated it. And my parents appreciated the tax deduction, too, you know, showing up there before the end of the year.
Yeah. You mentioned your parents. Your father, I guess you were, what, 13 when he passed away?
Yeah, he was a young man when he died. He died at 37, and it obviously wasn't easy. We didn't have much extra, and so I started working then when I was 13.
Well, regardless, it's a tough age to lose a parent.
It is. I think it took several years to, adjust to that. I think it's hard on anybody that suffers a loss like that, and I think it's, it definitely played a role in who I am.
How do you think it affected your outlook on the world?
Well, you know, I went through that. I also went through the loss of a wife at a young age. She was 42, my first wife. And I was just saying earlier today to one of my staff members that I am a believer that don't put off till tomorrow what you can do today. And I also see it working as an emergency medicine physician. I see life lost suddenly and at young ages. And so I'm a firm believer in accomplishing all that you'd like to accomplish as soon as possible. I fully understand that there are no tomorrows promised to us. And so if I'm thinking about doing something, I tend to accelerate and try to achieve that as promptly as possible because, tomorrow I might be gone. I've had that lesson drummed into me. And, certainly one needs to look to the future and invest oneself in one's future. But I'm well aware of the fact that you can't necessarily depend on the future to arrive.
You mentioned your first wife, Polly, dying at 42. I saw in one of your recent political ads how the experience of dealing with the costs associated with her care reinforced your views about our healthcare system. What do you feel you learned or understood better about our healthcare system from the perspective of a patient's loved one that maybe was different from the perspective of a physician?
Well, you know, the advertisement that you're referring to, it deals with something that happened to me late in the course of her illness. She was sick with colon cancer for 13 months before she passed away, and probably 6 to 8 weeks before she actually passed away. And she and I, we knew what was coming as far as her losing her life. And we were planning her funeral and planning the future of myself and our children. And lo and behold, one day in the mail arrived a letter from the insurance company. A few months earlier, she had been life flighted. She had been in critical condition in a hospital in Bloomington, Illinois here. And per her physician's decision-making, the physician in Bloomington and down at Barnes in St. Louis, they life-flighted her down to St. Louis. As a physician, I was just the husband. I had no say in what was happening, of course. As a physician, though, looking at it, it was very appropriate. She was in critical condition. Fast forward several months, and we got this letter from the insurance company saying we're going to refuse to pay for that medevac helicopter. It was a bill for about $17,000, and it was very. It's surely brought home to me what I've understood about the private health insurance industry for many years. It's all about maximizing investor return for the private health insurers, and I'm not looking for anybody's sympathy with that story. The point is that it's so unfortunate that here in America, stories like that happen over and over and over again, repeatedly in households throughout this country on a daily basis. And I'm convinced that we can do better so that families don't have to deal with a blow such as that at the time that they're sitting down and planning a funeral.
I want to get into more detail about healthcare and some other issues, but a reminder, this is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and today we offer you another chance to speak directly with a candidate running for a key office representing citizens of Central Illinois. My guest today is David Gill, the Democratic candidate running for Congress to represent the Illinois 13th Congressional District, which stretches from here in Champaign-Urbana all the way to the metro east of St. Louis. The district also incorporates the cities of Springfield, Decatur, and Bloomington-Normal, and lots of land in between. Dr. Gill is opposed by Republican Rodney Davis, who will appear on this program next week, and Independent John Hartman, who was on this show last month. We welcome your questions for David Gill at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. Or you can email your question to will-talk@illinois.edu. So you've long supported the idea of a single-payer healthcare system. How do you feel about the Affordable Care Act, which doesn't really change the system to single payer, but does address within the current largely employer-based system a way to have many millions more Americans insured?
You know, I've said frequently, Craig, that had I been in Congress in early 2010, I would have voted against the bill because you're right. It really doesn't change the overriding dynamic that we have turned over our health care system to a private health insurance industry whose number one mission is to maximize investor return. And they're not evil. I like to point that out. That's just what they're there for. The mistake is ours in turning over the system to an industry such as that. So I wouldn't have voted for the bill. That said, you're right. There are some very good aspects to the bill to the extent that I'm glad as time has gone by that the Supreme Court did not throw it away altogether. There would have been complete chaos, frankly, at that point. And I think it's good to preserve those initial first steps that the Affordable Care Act that Obamacare has. The president encourages us to call it Obamacare now. The things such as being able to have your children on your insurance policy until they're 26. The closing of the donut hole for our seniors. I've seen the damage that donut hole does in my emergency department. The inability of seniors at a certain level to get their prescriptions. The inability of insurance companies to exclude people because of pre-existing conditions. Those are all wonderful things, and I'm glad they're there. And of course, as somebody who would like to see Medicare expanded and improved to ultimately involve everybody, I feel that we can improve upon Obamacare. But I would add, too, that I've seen a lot of commercials questioning my support of Medicare that couldn't be further from the truth. I've been a doctor for 24 years. I've seen Medicare save thousands and thousands of lives. And, of course, I love Medicare. I've spent 20 years advocating for the growth of and improvement of Medicare, and the opposition, you know, deceitfully took something out of context in creating a commercial intended to scare voters, and you know, I think that's shameful. And let it be known that there is no bigger booster of Medicare than David Gill.
There's the question of what you would have done had you been in Congress and the Affordable Care Act came up for a vote. But maybe a more instructive question for me to ask you is, if you were elected to Congress, would you in the coming years focus your energy on ensuring effective implementation of the Affordable Care Act, or would you spend your time speaking out on behalf of a single payer system and a more dramatic overhaul of health care in America?
Oh, I think to some extent both, Craig. I certainly would put my energies into the implementation, and I think that a lot of that is going to roll forward without a congressperson necessarily taking any action. You know, the bill is a matter of law. It's already settled law, certainly settled law with what the Supreme Court did this summer. I certainly would like to see us improve upon it as well. And so to improve and expand Medicare, I think for the economic well-being of this country, as well as the health of our people, would be an important mission to set out upon. And, you know, we'll see where things go. But it's something I would have interest in.
What if you were elected, but the balance of power were to shift in Congress and you could find yourself in a minority and Republicans maybe controlling both the House and the Senate and maybe deciding to really focus on, if not a significant repeal of the Affordable Care Act, but drawing back some elements of it or making some changes to it, what then becomes your role in the minority? Is it, again, to defend the law that exists, or is it to say, I agree there need to be changes and I want to go in this other direction?
Well, I certainly wouldn't get behind them if they were standing up and hollering repeal the way that they keep hollering. I think that that's an irresponsible position. If they wanted to, you know, look at individual elements of the bill, depending on what it was that they were talking about, I would be open to listening. I'm not, I'm very independent minded. I would be interested in listening to the opposition, and I take pains to point out that I was not the candidate of choice of the party elders in the primary here, and I appreciate my independence, and I think the party has put some TV commercials on the air that I can't control, but the important thing with regards to that is that they won't be controlling me when I get to Washington. I'll be going there on behalf of the people that live here in this district, not on behalf of any of the Democratic Party elders.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and my guest is David Gill, the Democrat running for Congress seeking to represent Illinois' 13th congressional district. He's opposed by Republican Rodney Davis and independent candidate John Hartman. The newly drawn 13th district includes the cities of Champaign-Urbana, Decatur, Springfield, Bloomington-Normal, and stretches all the way to the metro east of St. Louis. We welcome your questions for Dr. Gill at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455, or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We also welcome questions and comments via our Facebook and Twitter pages. Phone numbers again, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. And we'll begin this morning with Ed in Urbana. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Hi, Dr. Gill. I just want to say appreciate you doing what you're doing and hope you keep it up. I guess a couple things I wanted to say was, one, I just wonder, you know, Obamacare, Medicare, anything, you know, red state, blue state. It seems to me anything that becomes labeled nowadays is liberal, conservative. Everything is such a polarizing thing that, you know, we get away from calling it what it is, health care, political discourse, you know, instead of, you know, dealing with, you know, each other, you know, different parties, whatever, respectfully and decently. We're just into, you know, being, I don't know, some kind of bigger animal than we used to be. That's uncontrollable. It seems like it's polarizing everyone. It's making too many things difficult. And you know, with the healthcare issue, this is, I guess, my second point. With the healthcare issue, I had the wonderful opportunity of having a couple of really bad allergic reactions in the last couple of weeks, and I had to go to the emergency room. I'm 50 years old. Had to go to the emergency room, and I broke out in hives. My blood pressure went to 90 over 70. Blah blah blah, and they, you know, they did wonderful things for me, and they were very, very well done. The first time I went in, I got right in. Everything was taken care of, and boy, I appreciated that. The second time I went in, I went on my own. We were able to use a medication that was given to me, an EpiPen, and get myself stabilized enough for my wife to drive me in. And when I got there, I took note of how packed, and this was on a Monday night. I thought Saturday nights are probably really packed, Sunday nights are really packed. I thought just how packed our emergency room is, and you know how, and this is locally here at Carl, and I thought, wow, you know, I mean, and a lot of the people, you know, it's hard to tell, you know, who's affluent, who's not, who's poor, who's rich. Especially at, you know, 12:30 at night, you know, people are in their pajamas half the time.
Sure.
But, it just seemed to me that I don't know, with the stuff that we went through several hours of just, you know, kind of sitting around, doing nothing. And then, you know, we start getting, got taken care of, which is fine. And they did a wonderful job again the second time around. But I just wonder, coming off of that, you know, I've already started receiving the bills, you know, and I have relatively good health care, but I've already started receiving the bills, you know, for co-pays, you know, and hundreds of dollars. And I thought, wow, hundreds of dollars is kind of expensive. And then I thought, what do these other people do?
All right. Ed, I'm sorry to stop you there, but I want to make sure we get to other calls, and I want to give Dr. Gill a chance to respond to some of the comments that you're making. So go ahead.
You know, I appreciate your experience, Ed, there in the emergency department, and it is. Month by month, it gets busier and busier, and I think that's because so many people have nowhere else to turn, and we see it on a regular basis, and it really becomes very chaotic, and I'm glad they got you in right away when your pressure was 90 over 70, certainly.
I just wanted you to talk about the tax situation with that and how we pay for the emergency room stuff.
Certainly.
I'm sorry.
Sure. I mean, we see many, many people in the emergency department where we don't see a penny coming from those individuals. There's so many uninsured people that we take care of that ultimately, as a society, we do pay for. And that's part of my argument in terms of creating an improved Medicare for all, because it's very wasteful. These people have nowhere else to turn, and so they'll come to the most expensive healthcare setting that there is, the emergency department, for a sore throat and a low-grade fever of 101 that they've had for a couple of days. And we spend a great deal of money, and ultimately we as a society pay that bill. It's a very indirect payment, but in order for the hospital to keep their doors open, keep that emergency department open, everybody else's charges are ultimately ratcheted up to keep the thing going. With regards to the polarization of our politics, I agree completely, and it's a shame. It's something that I've actually discussed with you know, your current representative here in Champaign-Urbana, Tim Johnson, you know, it's something that distresses him appropriately, and I think he grew very tired of it in Washington, D.C.
Well, you know, about a week or so ago, Congressman Johnson very publicly admonished both you and Rodney Davis for the way you were both conducting your campaigns.
Right. And, you know, and again, I really, while I have respect for Mr. Johnson, I respectfully disagree with the elements of what he had to write there, because the only things where I can't coordinate, I'm not allowed by law to coordinate with the DCCC. That's the organization running negative ads against my opponent. There are many organizations. It's now looking at the spending going to Election Day, it's almost $3.5 million of negative ads against me, many of which Rodney Davis likely cannot control. But Rodney Davis can control Rodney Davis for Congress. I can control David Gill for Congress. And my campaign has not run a single negative TV or radio ad.
Well, we're hearing that, though, from politicians in races all across the country. They're saying their campaigns are taking the high ground while congressional campaign committees do the attack ads, while these other groups do these attack ads, that they say the super PACs that we can't control. So when you get to Congress, is that something you would be willing to address in terms of campaign finance or campaign reform that says maybe this approach is not right?
Oh, I've said it for many years, Craig. And something, what we're really seeing now, and again, I would go back, I heard that in your voice. Again, there's two things that can be controlled here locally, Rodney Davis for Congress and David Gill for Congress. Rodney Davis for Congress is running negative ads about me, and we are not doing the same with respect to TV and radio. But I have said for a long time that we need to change the way we finance campaigns, and what is especially needed now, we are seeing the impact, the terrible impact of that Citizens United decision, where these big super PACs disguised, they don't even have to disclose, who's putting the money into them. Aetna made a paperwork error so that we know the American Action Network is Aetna. 2 days ago, they just put another $1 million into this race to spread evil lies about me. Anyhow, I signed a pledge quite some time ago that I would like to work toward a constitutional amendment to undo the impact of Citizens United, a simple amendment that declares that corporations are not people and that money is not speech. Because this is terrible, and the majority of Republicans in this country agree with that and would like to see what's going on undone.
Let's take another call. We have Paul on the line from Champaign County. Hi, Paul.
Hi, good morning. I wanted to ask about sort of fiscal policy, but it actually impinges on health care, because it seems to me that the percentage that we spend on health care for no good results in a large extent is why we have a lot of the looming debt and the crisis. And I just would like for you to say something about Simpson-Bowles, because it calls for $1 of tax increase for $3 of cuts, seeming very much the wrong direction. And how much of the healthcare crisis do you think actually contributes to the debt? I mean, I already know the answer, but I'd like for you to tell us about that. And just as an afterthought, sorry about that, but this local Champaign County Healthcare Consumers is investigating a pretty much unpublicized clause in PCA that allows for nonprofit insurance companies, and about 20 states or so, I think I've heard, are actually investigating this. It would be it's not a federal. Well, anyway, I'll just leave that open in the air. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call.
Yeah, there are elements to Simpson-Bowles that I appreciate. The overall concept behind it, I appreciate. And yet there are parts that I don't agree with. And I think you're right. I think the emphasis being on more on spending cuts than revenue increases, I don't necessarily agree with. I've spoken at length about the fact that we need to have the millionaires and the billionaires in this country begin to pay their fair share again. I'm running against a man who has said that they should keep their tax breaks forever, and I think that's wrong. I think the fact that we have a quarter of the large corporations in this country paying taxes at a rate of zero or an effective negative rate is also wrong. And so I think this almost reflexive response to not raise taxes on the richest in this country is a mistake. Certainly there's, and we can talk at length about spending cuts that are needed. I think both items are needed when you're dealing with a $16 trillion deficit. Let me be clear, though. The one other big lie that I hear about myself in these TV commercials is with respect to taxes, and I will never vote to raise taxes on those individuals making less than $250,000 a year. That's not something that I have any interest in doing, and I won't support that. You're speaking my language when you talk about the way that healthcare enmeshes itself into our economy, and the fact that we finance our healthcare in such an unwise way really takes its toll upon our economy and leaves us with financial difficulties that the rest of the world doesn't have to face. And as the world has become this global economy over the past couple of decades, our failure to move forward with appropriate healthcare financing has really taken its toll. When I was in medical school here in Champaign-Urbana, healthcare was maybe 11% of our GDP. Now it's 18 plus. You know, it's gone from roughly a tenth to a fifth. And it's, I believe it's even more than the 18 plus because there are unmeasured ways in which it impacts itself. The fact that GM has to pay an extra $1,600 per vehicle relative to what other countries are doing for similar products certainly makes it more difficult for GM to compete in the global marketplace. And so, in fact, I've often said that, you know, when I get to Washington, I would like to reach across and talk with my Republican, Congress people about the economics of this. You know, I deal on a daily basis in the emergency department with the healthcare part of it. And for my spirit, the morality of it or the immorality of leaving people suffering and leaving them to die at a rate of every 12 minutes in this country just because they don't have health insurance. For me, that's sufficient to say we must do something different. But the economics of it, I think, should appeal to virtually everybody because virtually everybody other than health insurance companies, because it's crushing us economically. And I'm sure you have some figures there, but I know that we will be far better off economically when we release that 20 to 40% of our healthcare dollars that we currently, throw away on a health insurance product that doesn't really provide anybody with health or care. And take that money back and put it into people, put it into job creation, allow it to flourish within the broader economy. And I have no question but that we would all be far better off.
You've made a point here several times and throughout the campaign, touting your experience as a physician and how that informs your views on healthcare. But you've also run for Congress now four times. Is there a threshold you cross where you stop being seen as a doctor and start being seen more as a perennial campaigner for public office?
Well, you know, that's something that I gave a lot of thought to before deciding to run. And I would offer that you talk about four times. I would say this is the first time in Illinois 13. This is a very different situation. You know, when I ran previously, I was a committed standard bearer, committed to some of the ideals that I've upheld all my adult life, starting from a 40-point handicap in that old district. We did relatively well, but relatively well when you're starting from a 40-point handicap certainly doesn't yield anything close to victory. And so this is an entirely different thing. But, I mean, you're right. There's certainly people's perceptions to deal with, and the experience has helped me immensely in many different ways, the previous experience in the old district. But it's an entirely different animal running in this district.
And I want to talk a little bit more about that as well as taking more calls and emails in just a minute. We are talking with David Gill, the Democrat running for Congress in Illinois' 13th district. He faces Republican Rodney Davis and Independent John Hartman in next month's election. We welcome your questions at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. It's time for a short break. This is Focus.
Nate Silver is famous for his New York Times blog, 538, where he analyzes the political polls and predicts election outcomes. On the next Fresh Air, Silver talks about the science of prediction as it applies to political polls, baseball, and poker. His new book is called The Signal and the Noise. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and at 7 p.m. on AM 580.
WILL programming is made possible by Sangamon Auditorium, University of Illinois, Springfield. Presenting Savion Glover, demonstrating his reverence for the art and legends of tap dance in Soul Sanctuary this Sunday, October 14th at 7. Information at sangamonauditorium.org.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and today we offer you another chance to speak directly with a candidate running for a key office representing citizens of Central Illinois. My guest today is David Gill, the Democratic candidate running for Congress to represent the Illinois 13th District, which stretches from here in Champaign-Urbana all the way to the metro east of St. Louis. It's a newly drawn district. It incorporates the cities of Springfield, Decatur, and Bloomington-Normal, and lots of land in between. Dr. Gill is opposed by Republican Rodney Davis, who will appear on this program next week, and Independent John Hartman, who was on this show last month. To join our conversation, you can call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL, or you can email your question to will-talk@illinois.edu. Let's go next to Doug in Spring Bay. Doug, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. First on Obamacare, I've been hearing now since the law was passed how terrible it is, and I'm just thinking to myself that it's the law of the land. Maybe we should give it a few years and then come back and start talking about how we can improve it. But you're running for national office, for a federal office. What ideas do you have that would cause you to run for, let's say, a national office rather than a state office? What do you think are the three or four big ideas or problems, issues that we're facing as a nation that you would like to deal with? And I'll get off and listen off the phone. Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much for the call.
Thanks, Doug. Well, you know, I tell people that what I've witnessed in my career as a physician is what provoked me to run in the first place. And but I'm not a single-issue candidate. I've been reading the newspaper cover to cover since I was 7 years old, and so I'm interested in a wide variety of things. I think it's a wonderful question that you ask, and I would speak almost more thematically with regards to answering that. And that is that I think, like many people, I see a Washington, D.C. that really fails to seem to be working for its citizens anymore. And I think that it's my disappointment with our federal government in that it seems that on both sides of the aisle, these guys take the money from the drug companies and the oil companies and the insurance companies and the Wall Street banks, and then they're working on their behalf and not on our behalf. And so something I've tried to emphasize is that I'm very proud of the fact that my campaign doesn't take a single penny from those interests, from the Wall Street banks and the big corporations that brought this economy to its knees 5 years ago and that have made life so very difficult for so many people in this country for a long time. I think that when we have representation at the federal level that is there, when representatives are there strictly out of concern for their fellow man and woman, that then we can solve any problem that faces us, whether it be affordable health care, affordable education, jobs, retirement security. But it's this failure of Congress people, the way that you don't get a public option in your health care reform because WellPoint is so heavily invested in the process. You get a Medicare prescription drug bill that sends $2 trillion away because Pfizer and Merck are so invested in it that Uncle Sam agrees to not bargain on price. One of the most egregious examples of this. You get wars fought for reasons that we look at each other and say, why are we there? Why are we at war in that place? There's example after example of a Washington, D.C. that's not looking out for our well-being. I decided when I was 6 years old that I wanted to be a doctor. Somehow I found a passion within my heart to be of service to my fellow man and woman, and it's that same passion that drives me to try to take one of these seats in Washington for those same reasons.
Let's go next to Margot in Champaign. Hi, Margot.
Hi. Good morning, Dr. Gill. I am a former public school teacher. I'm retired, and I'm also a retired financial advisor. Is that a pair for you? But public education is very dear to my heart. My husband and I have six children. We educated them all in public schools. We have a two-star general, a school principal, a dentist, a computer engineer, so public education is so important to us. I'd like to ask you a couple of questions. Because we're being surpassed by other countries in educating our children, Finland, Japan, China, and 10 other countries, Korea. Our economy is, those countries are all ahead of us in education. Our economy is directly related to how well we educate our children. how do you view education in this country, one? What do you see as the largest problem in educating our children? And how do you see and how do you view the role of charter schools in this country?
Well, I appreciate your comments and your questions, Margo, and I'm very proud to have been recommended by the Illinois Education Association and endorsed by the Illinois Federation of Teachers. I agree with you. I also have six children. After my wife Polly died, we had three, and I fell in love again and with a woman, Elaine, who brought me three more wonderful children, and all six of ours have been educated in public schools, and I'm sure you're very proud, as I am, of my children. And I agree completely that it's a huge problem, public education in this country, and it really impacts upon our future, both the future of the children who are going to wind up not having the opportunities that their parents and grandparents had, it's going to be a problem for our society as a whole. You're right. We do. We fall further and further behind other countries. And I think, again, it's a question of priorities. And again, it's because of who's funding these the representatives in Washington, D.C. We need people that'll put education at a very high footing. It can't just be talk. And we need to invest ourselves in our children's future. And I think this is amongst the highest priorities, and we don't see enough of it. I think that when you get serious about having the millionaires and billionaires pay their fair share and corporations pay their fair share, that then you can have the resources that you need to invest in children. And we've seen the federal government pull itself back further and further from public education. And I think a lot of the decisions that get made within our public schools should be made at a local level. But I think there's a place for Uncle Sam to invest himself, and certainly in higher education. We've seen Pell Grants stripped time and time again through the years. When I was going to school, two-thirds of the funding that was available from the federal government was in the form of grants such as that, and now it's two-thirds of it is in these loans to young people. And the Ryan budget strips another 45% from the Pell Grants, and I've tried to call out my Republican opponent. He says he supports parts of the Ryan budget, and I can't get him to let us know what parts he supports and what parts he doesn't support. But I think it's a question of what we want to invest ourselves in. And, rather than wars for questionable purposes, rather than giving subsidies to the oil companies, I think that our children are far more important than those things, and that we should be investing ourselves in that.
Well, you mentioned Pell Grants, and certainly that's one way to address funding for higher education. But what about public education in elementary and secondary schools? What specifically would you seek to do if you were in Congress that you believe would affect an improvement in the quality of public education?
Yeah, I'd like to see grants available to young people who decide to pursue a career in education in which they put themselves into rural communities, underserved schools, in inner city schools, have programs such as that. It used to be, two, 3 decades ago that upwards of 25 or 30% of the funding came from Uncle Sam, and now it's, 9 or 10%? And, I think it's a question of what we want to invest ourselves in. I think that...
Didn't we have that, though, under the Clinton administration? Wasn't there a development of programs that that provided funding so that recent college graduates would spend a year or 2 years or a certain amount of time in schools that were underfunded or underserved?
Well, that's true now. That's right now, young people coming out of our colleges, if they go into education and spend 10 years, then all of the money they borrowed from Uncle Sam is paid.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
They don't have to worry about paying that money back. So they're relieved of that debt. But I would like to know more about what you see as the problems right now. What are the big problems that you see in educating our kids?
Well, I don't think that it's our teachers. I've been disappointed at the tone that's been taken over the past couple of years, where public employees have been lashed out at, and the whole process of collective bargaining has been called into question. I think, you know, a lot of politicians say that they view teachers as noble and heroic, and I agree with that, and I think that we should stand by them, and to see them sort of thrown over the cliff in many instances disappoints me greatly, and so I don't believe that it's our teachers. I believe that it's a question of fully investing ourselves. I think you've got teachers in the classrooms who are having to go out and spend their own money on supplies, and that shouldn't be the case. You've got very large class sizes, and that shouldn't be the case. I think that when I used to say that had we chosen not to invade Iraq, that that would have afforded 50 to 100 years of college for every B student coming out of high school. And I think you need to look at things like, you know, you need to view the world through that perspective. Stop feeding the oil companies and the millionaires, and put it into investing in our children. And I think that you'll get better performance. Make teaching attractive. Right now, when these young people are in college, teaching doesn't reward people financially nearly as much as careers in engineering and finance.
We have about 7 or 8 minutes left, so I'm going to ask you, Dr. Gill, and also our callers, try to keep questions and answers relatively a bit shorter, just so that we can get to as many calls as possible here. We'll go next to Jonathan in Champaign. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, Mr. Gill. My question is in regards to, I'm not sure if you're familiar, on 60 Minutes, a while back they had an investigation as far as House and Senate members making stock decisions based on insider information that basically the same kind of information that Martha Stewart went to jail for. And in the course that affects their legislative activity, you know, based their decisions, bills affecting the economy. But they tried to pass a bill to basically make that illegal for House and Senate members to do that. And it only got a few votes. So is that something that you would support or try to get going again?
Yeah. Yes, I'd be very interested in that. You know, that was one of the good things that Tim Johnson did. Mr. Johnson was at the forefront, I think, of trying to make it illegal for that to take place. And so I'd be very interested in pushing forward with something like that.
Okay, that's good news because it only got a few votes the last time they tried to.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think we need to clean up Congress. We talk all the time about strong medicine to clean up Congress, and I think that's one element of it. I'm somebody who believes in term limits as well.
How many terms?
You know, I don't have a specific number, Craig. You know, I think that perhaps a 12-year total for being there. However, you want to do that with your, you know, just because it's a multiple of the
two and four, six, exactly. Yeah.
And but you know, whatever it is, I just think there's so many brilliant people in this country who have wonderful ideas with regards to moving our country forward, and I think that we should make room for them to come on in, and I think we'd all be better served if it was a service rather than a career.
All right, let's go next to caller in Sullivan, Illinois. Good morning.
Yeah, two or three statements. I worked my way through school. I didn't have anybody holding my hand and whatever I got a master's degree, no problem there. I don't believe that you should confiscate anybody's property or whatever through taxation. I mean, you know, if you make $200,000 or more, fine, but it ought to be yours, and why should you take my money and feed some turkey or whatever to go ahead and whatever. If I go out here and I buy a piece of property or a farm or whatever, there's nobody that's going to repay my debt except me if I don't want to get out and work for it. I don't believe in that. I mean, everybody wants everything that you have. They don't want to work for it. And I have a statement I keep. Improper planning on your part does not constitute a crisis on mine.
You know, I'm sorry to interrupt, but this is a comment that I think a lot of us have heard or felt or heard expressed throughout the country over the last 4 or 5 years, going back to the the financial crisis in 2008 and the sense that that there were these companies that were too big to fail. Mm-hmm. And so it was necessary that taxpayers bail them mm-hmm. out. And there's been this sort of sense of, is there a bailout culture that has developed around Congress in Washington, D.C., and in our policies in this country? And I wonder if you are hearing that specific concept from voters, some folks saying, I just want to pay my fair share, but I don't want to cover for somebody else's mistakes.
Mm-hmm. Very much so. I mean, and again, I think it points to the Wall Street banks and the corporations that have come to dominate Washington, D.C. And I agree with the gentleman in the sense that he shouldn't have to pay extra. I mean, we all have to pay something in taxes. And if you want paved roads and you want police officers and a military and, you know, stop signs at the roads and perhaps a public library and, you know.
But
I have no interest in having any further taxes on a gentleman from Sullivan who's making less than $250,000 a year.
Right, but this is, and it's, I only mention the banks as sort of the starting point
right.
of several examples. The auto industry bailout, mortgages that were deemed inappropriate that shouldn't have been presented in the first place to people who couldn't afford them, the bailouts associated with that, that's created this sort of concept in some voters' minds that this is all that's happening in Washington.
Right. And again, I think that it's an outgrowth of who's funding these congresspeople's campaigns. You know, the banks got bailed out. I disagreed with that bailout. Those guys are heavily invested, though, in the Washington, D.C. Congresspeople's offices. And the realtor, the mortgages, they're also heavily invested in congresspeople's campaigns. And again, I think by taking money from ordinary men and women, as I do, that's who I intend to go to work for when I get to Washington.
Let's go next to Eric in Urbana. Eric.
Yes. Great time to get a mental block.
anyway, happens to us all.
The fellow that was running the older fellow book, A Manifesto, he wrote that we have troops in 130 countries, which is a tremendous waste amount of money. Perhaps you read George Will's column several months ago in which he quoted two congressmen that our defense budget is not even auditable. They spend well over $1.5 billion a day. It's not even auditable. And in Tom Colburn's book, A Breach of Trust, he says the same thing toward the end of the book, that he tried to trace some of the stuff and it's not even auditable. And here Romney wants to increase their budget, and it's going down a rat hole because you can't verify anything. So I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Thanks very much for the call.
Yeah, it's bloated. The military budget is bloated. And, you know, yeah, what Mitt Romney is asking for is more than what even the Pentagon is asking for. You know, the president has suggested some cuts, some modest cuts, the cuts that the Pentagon itself has asked for, you know, about $500 billion over a decade. And I think if the Pentagon, who knows our military better than the leaders at the Pentagon? And I think that we should put some faith in them with regards to what they need today.
Let's go next to Brian in Champaign. Brian.
Yes. Actually, I wanted to ask about the issue of Wall Street prosecutions. I did want to note that on the air one day on this station, there was a CIA expert on the CIA black budget who noted it may be as large as $150 billion. And that's not even on any books, right? But in any case, leaving that aside, Wall Street prosecutions, the SNL crisis, the Reagan administration, as much problems as they may have produced in their time. They did have 10,000 prosecutions based on the SNL crisis, which was astronomically smaller than what we had happen in 2007, 2008. There have been, I think, 1 to 2, 3 prosecutions maybe in all since this, and I'm hoping that someone like you and others in Congress will call for real prosecution of these figures to push the Obama or maybe the Romney administration to move forward on this, and also to try to help underwater homeowners. It's outrageous that Freddie and Fannie, which were problematic in all this, are now refusing to forgive debt and so forth for a lot of homeowners, and the Obama administration has not done nearly enough, even though they've tried to push Fannie and Freddie to move forward with that. But I'd just like to hear what you have to say about these.
All right. Thanks for the question.
I think that such prosecutions would be appropriate, and I think that they would help some with the raw feelings that you're talking about, Craig, out there in the community, you know, amongst the voters. They see that some people got very fat and rich through this borderline questionable criminal activity, and there's been no one that's had to pay the piper, so to speak, and I think that some of the bitterness and recrimination on the part of the voting public is because they see these individuals getting off scot-free.
Finally, you, Mr. Davis, and Mr. Hartman all face a challenge of geography in this race. You have strong ties to Champaign. You've worked in some other communities in central Illinois, but we're a long way from Collinsville and Edwardsville in the metro east of St. Louis. How would you hope to serve the interests of all of the communities in this district, noting the district itself is shaped as it is?
Sure. Well, I've been running in this district since June of 2011, and I've gotten to know a lot of wonderful people in Montgomery, McCoup, and Madison counties, Jersey and Greene, and their interests are my interests. I think their interests are very similar to the interests of those in Decatur and Springfield and Champaign and Bloomington. And so I think by having gotten to know them over a period of time, I look forward to serving all of them. I think, again, you know, people are looking for retirement security. They're looking for the ability to send their kids to college and have a job and be able to afford health care. And those things really cut across even a big swath of land that Illinois 13 is.
Dr. David Gill is the Democrat running for Congress seeking to represent Illinois' 13th congressional district. He faces Republican Rodney Davis and Independent John Hartman in next month's election. Dr. Gill, thanks for being with us today.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks to the listeners as well and those who called in.
Also, remember, all three candidates will participate in a 13th district congressional debate on November 1st at 7 p.m. right here at WILL. It's hosted by Illinois Public Media in collaboration with the League of Women Voters of Illinois and WCIA. It will be broadcast on WILL-TV, WILL-AM, WCIX-TV, live streaming on will.illinois.edu, and a number of other public television and radio stations throughout the state will broadcast the debate as well. Again, that's November 1st at 7 p.m. Today's show was produced by Travis Stanzel. Kyle Mabry's our technical director. He handled your calls. I'm Craig Cohen.